Welcome here. It is good to be with you. I sometimes think that maybe we're living in an age where, I mean, if you think about, if you read kind of grand overviews of the history of the West or European influenced sort of history stories, and you're kind of looking for the high points, one of them is often the invention of the printing press. And this sort of coincides with the Reformation in terms of Christian history, or the history of Christianity rather, and so this idea that notions about the divine that have up to this point in history been the unique provenance of an elite group of people, because to the degree that these things are accessed by text, the texts were in Latin. People didn't speak Latin. The priests spoke Latin, so you could tell me it means whatever you want, and I'm not going to be able to look for myself for sure. And so that kind of happens at the same time that the printing press happens, and suddenly, from the long view of history, suddenly, anyone can learn to read, and anyone can have access to these previously sort of mysterious, cordoned off sacred texts. And to other texts as well, to anything that could be written down and read. So also to the writings of the philosophers or the scientists or the political thinkers and so on and so forth. And so these things kind of coincide, and they launch this age in which we treat what is written in a way that we never have collectively before, and that the oral traditions start to kind of lose some of their oomph in the culture making, and what is written becomes the hallmark of what is true or what is trustworthy or what can be accessed by way of knowing what is true and trustworthy and all those kinds of things. And a lot of good, of course, has happened out of all of that. I'm also starting to wonder if maybe we're living in an age where we're beginning to sense the limits of what we can mine from written words, from what can be published. This is not to denigrate that, not to diminish the value of that, but rather to say it's not everything. And I think we're starting to kind of go, about that a little bit. And it feels like in some ways the book of nature, I won't give you the background on that idea, it's not mine, but this feeling that maybe the book of nature is starting to speak to us again, even to those of us that haven't been trained to readily understand what that book is saying. And I know I'm overlapping book, and maybe it wouldn't be out of line to suggest that nature has never stopped speaking to us, but now she is starting to shout in an all-out attempt to get our attention. And it seems to me that we could do far worse than to look around us and ask, who has been trained to hear what the land is saying and to attend to those voices in a fresh, unique way? And an obvious starting place, it seems to me, is to simply acknowledge that we live, if we live here geographically, we live in the middle of a place and of multiple people groups that have continued to practice what is needed to hear that wisdom, despite concerted attempts being made to eradicate those traditions. I think it's fair to say that trading a relationship of mutual regard, trust, or even affection for more direct access to resources, which is one way to read the history of colonization, that's never a good idea. And it's clearer by the day that the actual cost extracted was, and often still is, utterly unconscionable. We live on Treaty One land. We live in a place where the indigenous peoples of this continent made their way by listening to what the earth was saying long before the people who were making their way by considering what the texts were saying got here. And we can all learn more about that from them if we will come with a beginner's mind and a humble heart, seeking relationship and friendships that are built on trust between equals. Wouldn't have been that long ago that what I have next in my notes here would have felt to me at least like melodrama. Increasingly, that is not the way it feels to me. What I wrote is, I don't think it's too late. Having said that, I feel like I know a lot of people who feel like it is too late. And that's a space in which it is extremely difficult to find hope and to live with hope and intentionality. So here's a question for your consideration as we pause to be still for a few moments together. The question I'm going to ask it of myself. I invite you to ask it of yourself if you choose. The question is, do I know anyone that knows how to listen to the earth? Do I know anyone that knows how to listen to the land, to nature, to creation, to whatever language we want to use for both the material and the mystic, the spiritual that is all around us and makes our that we make our home in and of? Do I know anyone who knows how to listen to the earth? Invite us this morning as our practice, shared practice, to just stop for a few moments and be with that question. Breathe intentionally if you wish. I will breathe. So if you want to share a practice with me this morning, it'll just be square breathing. I don't want to have to think about the practice this morning. I want the practice to help my body to be free and be present. And in this particular case, I want to be present to this question. Do I know anyone that knows how to listen to the earth? All right, so let's take a few moments with that, and then we'll carry on with our exploration together. A bunch of my kids, my musician kids, really like the band Toto. And this came, and it continues to come, as a happy surprise to their dad, who was pretty into that band back in the day. And I can remember, in fact, by way of reflecting on that fandom, I can remember being on a climbing trip in Utah, which meant that I was living out of my backpack, and still buying a vinyl copy, you know, like a record, an LP of the seventh one, the album, the seventh one, Toto's album, despite the fact that I really had no good way to carry it around, and I knew that it would be at least a month before I could put it on a turntable to listen to it. But I was in the U.S., and I knew that that album wouldn't be released in Canada till considerably later, so I had to do it. I was compelled. I could have bought the cassette tape, and I could have played it on my Walkman. Yep, that's how I rolled. But I didn't. I wanted the bigger artwork. I wanted the liner notes. I wanted the whole meal deal. But people, let's think about this. That was back in what? 1988? I mean, the earth was still cooling, right? The dinosaur tracks hadn't even properly congealed yet. The point is, the music, this music is old now, and my kids like it. I think I've mentioned before, some of them also like Bon Jovi, so maybe I should just chalk this up to the unaccountable tastes of youth. At any rate, it turns out that that Toto carries on. In our house, they carry on primarily in the classics, their classics, if you will, but they also are carrying on as a newly configured band built up around two of the original members, like these days, at the moment. It's interesting, to me at least, to hear the founding guitarist Steve Lukather, who in the rock guitar world is a bit of a guitar god. Interesting to listen to him talk about that process of bringing in new people. Like, there's two original members, right? And everybody else is new. He says it's a bit like making gumbo. You put a bunch of ingredients together. Sometimes it's awesome, and sometimes it's just a gooey mess. Sometimes this whole thing about assembling our own spirituality, which we have occasion to do under the present circumstances in our culture and in this point in history in a unique way, I think. But sometimes that whole thing about assembling our own spirituality can feel a little bit like that making gumbo idea. We've got some of the original pieces. We've got some of the, or to reassembling a new band, maybe better. We've got some of the original pieces. We've got some of the voices. We've got the melodies. We've got the beats. We've got these themes we grew up with. And maybe in terms of assembled spirituality, maybe it's a couple of big ideas. It's ideas like grace or forgiveness or loving one another or being willing to do hard things when love calls for it, or the idea that life is more than we can see, and yet there's an intersection between the unseen and unknown and the known. Like, maybe it's those kinds of things. But a bunch of the ideas that we had in the early going might be as dead and gone as Toto's original drummer. By which I mean no disrespect. I mean, how could I diss the guy that gave us that great groove at the beginning of the song Rosanna? Not to mention all the other outstanding parts of that track, which I listened to isolated from all the rest of the mix last week. Just the drums. Astonishing piece of playing. I read someone last week who described the drumming on that tune, which was recorded in 1982. Yes, there was recording technology. As still being a masterclass in what drummers should do in the studio. How could I diss that? Jeff Porcaro, the drummer who played that, left us about 30 years ago. But ask pretty much any aspiring rock drummer about this tune and they'll know about it and you'll get an earful. Some things endure, often because they capture something essential or outstanding or inspiring. The sorts of things that we are still learning about, learning from, and striving to enact for ourselves. In this community, for example, I know that there's a wide variety of perspectives on traditional Christianity. Some of us might feel at home with it, or even that we cherish some aspects of that tradition, while others really don't identify with it at all, in many cases never have, and probably more than a few of us find it increasingly disinteresting or irrelevant. And there are some of us for whom it's mostly dangerous. It's the tradition in which and in the name of which a lot of damage was done, a religion whose gatekeepers were experienced as arrogant, inflexible, misogynistic, racist, homophobic, maybe even outright incontrovertibly abusive. In those circumstances, there might be next to nothing akin to that sort of greatest hits idea left to work with when it comes to, you know, getting the band back together one more time. Or maybe to use another metaphor, considering accessing aspects of that tradition might feel more like wondering about going to see a movie starring someone that has been revealed as an abusive person. That sort of challenging space of it's still a compelling story, and the party in question is still good at their craft, but I can't unknow what I've learned, and that taints everything. And yet, when we apply some of these images to our spiritual lives, we have to consider that none of us assembles our spirituality in a vacuum. Even if we consider this experience in light of the stages that we've been talking about, we take the things that we've learned with us from stage to stage. We reconfigure them, we re-understand them, we reframe them for sure. But in many ways, they're part of our DNA. So, for example, if we take a stage one idea like right and wrong being very black and white, that we would learn early developmentally, even as chronologically as children, never mind spiritually as early in our development, the idea that there are some things that we might still, as adults, even with a more complex view of moral structures and their implications, we might still say of something that's just wrong. And so that's an echo, that's in our DNA, sort of a surviving way of thinking about right and wrong as a binary, for example. Right? So we take certain aspects of every stage with us as we travel along. Now the drummer, to come back to my little Toto illustration here, the drummer in this current configuration of Toto is a guy named Robert, his nickname is Sput, Robert Seawright. And if you're a Snarky Puppy fan, you'll recognize Seawright as Snarky Puppy's drummer, or one of them. So a pretty great player, as you might be able to imagine if you've ever listened to Snarky Puppy. But think about it. Would you want to be the person behind the kit in a room full of rabid Toto fans when that song Rosanna, with its iconic drum intro, comes up on the set list? Like, in that moment, if you're Robert Seawright, are you a copycat? Are you just a lesser iteration of, you know, a different great one? Or do you just start there because the starting place continues to challenge and amaze and groove like mad and then go on from there to offer something further, your own interpretation, your own expression, your own nuance? Do you try to duplicate an old idea Or do you take that idea and keep evolving it? If you look at the brief description of the table offered on our Facebook page, you'll see the word uncertainty within the first sentence. It would be hard to get through a talky bit, at least if I'm responsible for it, without encountering some variation on the theme or the working assumption that certainty is not within our grasp. And it wasn't that long ago, chronologically, that people in general in the Western world, with our particular emphasis on the testable nature of scientific truth, were in confident pursuit of certainty. If you grew up around traditional Christianity, again, culture-informing religion in some ways here, there was the same emphasis on certainty, but in this case, it was not pinned to testable things. It was pinned to things that had to be apprehended without proof, the language used for that being faith. So this is kind of, that's incredibly broad strokes, leaves out all sorts of nuance, of course. But there was a collective commitment to certainty and its possibility in the culture. And then, in the name of science, and from within its own vanguard, comes this guy named Werner Heisenberg. Heisenberg was a German theoretical physicist who established a number of laws and principles that formed the foundation for what we would now call quantum mechanics. And perhaps it should go without saying that he was a smart guy. His work won him the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1932. The theory that bears his name is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. The principle itself is a bit of a mind bender, as you might be able to imagine. In very short form, we won't spend a lot of time on this, but in very short form, it states that, quote, the more precisely the position of a particle is determined, the less precisely its momentum can be known, and vice versa. In other words, science people, feel free to take me to task here, but in other words, when it comes to the material world, we can get a glimpse of where a particle is, or of how much momentum it has, or how fast it's going might be one way to think of that. That's not entirely accurate, but by way of contrast, we can get a glimpse of where it is or how fast it's going, but not both. And to the degree that we can see one of those more clearly, we will see the other one less clearly. That's Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Now, as to where that particle is headed, never mind how fast it's going or where it is, as when it comes to where it's headed, further research suggests that particles, and I don't know how you feel about this, but when I'm talking about particles, I'm talking about the stuff we're made of, the stuff that the Earth and everything around us is made of. When it comes to particles and where they're headed, further research has suggested that particles can be in more than one place at one time. Because that first idea wasn't crazy enough, right? So here's the upshot. Unless we're in denial about the science, and some of us may well be, unless we're in denial about that, though, we are not in pursuit of certainty any longer, even from a scientific, what can be tested point of view. That doesn't take us into certainty. If we test these things at these kinds of levels of science, we find that we are in pursuit of mystery. We are in pursuit of the mind-boggling nature of what we are both surrounded by and made of. That when we pursue those things, we are not leaning into certitude. We are leaning into something else. Now, here's one way to think about Heisenberg's work. If Heisenberg hadn't been open to ideas other than the prevailing ones, we might still be thrashing around trying to prove something that his work demonstrated could not be proven. But he started out in the same place as everybody else, with the same information as everybody else, playing the same groove, if you will, as everybody else, but he didn't just stay there. Now, since in general terms, at least, religion can reasonably be seen to imitate culture, to be made by culture, or to think of itself as the transformer or enemy of culture, and usually over his time not winning those last two contests, how do these notions inform the way we think about something like self-assembled spirituality in the age of uncertainty? And if we are going to take into such a project, that assembly of spirituality, anything from the traditions we might have grown up with, how might we regard those artifacts, those things we're bringing along with us? Are we going to copy-paste them? or are we going to begin with the understanding that these ideas are ours to evolve? Perhaps we'll even go beyond that. Perhaps we're going to recognize in our exploration that these ideas were evolving when they were handed to us. So it's not even that novel for us to continue on that trajectory. This is not a thing that the gatekeepers might have tended to say in religion land. We might not have heard a whole lot about, you know, this idea was in motion from the beginning. It's in motion now. Your job is to keep it in motion, to keep evolving it, to keep unfolding it, to keep transforming it, to keep changing it. Nope. Here's the text. Here's this particular tribe's interpretation of the text. And because the text says that God is unchanging, the interpretation is unchanging as well. And you just need to get it and get it right and do it right. And then all's well. Much more prevailing message, right? What if that's just not the way this whole thing actually works? Maybe if we take a deep enough dive into the tradition that we're from, we're going to see that those ideas are sourced in something evolving, and that they stand on the foundation of a commitment to change, to an ever-expanding consciousness, a growing heart capacity for loving one another, not just from within a tribe, but in ways that transcend the negative expressions of that very idea of tribalism. I'm going to take a bit of a chance here. I think I can make the argument that in the Christian tradition, the teachings of the rabbi that inspired the formation of that religion associated with him contain the seeds of this. And not in some oblique, you know, need a degree in theology and fluency in Greek and Hebrew or original languages, not in that kind of a way. In the end, I don't think this is about elitism. I don't think it's about starting with the assumption that all the notes have already been played, but rather that what makes the great songs great is that they can always be taken somewhere new and fresh without losing their essence. Do you ever wonder why so many people cover Leonard Cohen's song Hallelujah, for instance? Or like the astonishingly great local funk band Ego Spank's cover of Beatles tunes that I was hearing live on Friday night. That might all sound incredibly vague and even a bit kind of woo-woo. So let me see if I can bring it home a little bit. I'm going to talk about a Jesus story here, and I think it's important in our context, perhaps especially, for you to know that I'm not assuming any particular beliefs about who Jesus was. My assumptions are just that, like with the Toto song, we have an artifact, we have a starting place with these stories. In the stories as we have them, Jesus seems to have an abiding commitment to metaphors involving small seeds and big trees. On several occasions, using several different particular images, Jesus says something along the lines of, if you had faith the size of a mustard seed, you could command something to happen and it would. Probably the best known particular expression of this is the text where Jesus says, if you had faith the size of a mustard seed, you could tell this mountain to move and it would move. Anybody here grow up in a church that had a give us this mountain fundraising campaign to pay off the mortgage or, you know, something like that? It seems to be a hard to resist metaphor for surmounting the insurmountable. Maybe it's the obviousness of it that makes it not my personal favorite as a metaphor. When it comes to Jesus talking about small seeds and big trees, I prefer the one from Luke. I prefer Luke's version of almost all of these stories, honestly. But I prefer the one from Luke where, as we have the story these days, Jesus says, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it will obey you. Oh, yeah, I love that. If you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, be uprooted and planted in the sea, and it will obey you. Anybody here have any memories of, like, roof-raising sermons on faith involving flying mulberry trees, like landing and taking root in the middle of the ocean? Because I don't. Oh, man. Maybe uprooting mulberry trees just lacks the necessary rhetorical oomph to pry loose some extra dollars. I'm not sure. Whatever the case, It's the other end of the sentence that forms the moment I keep being drawn back to, even when, as we talked about last week, I'm, you know, awash in my own version of incredulity toward big stories. Most of us have probably heard somebody expound at some point, if we grew up around Christian religion, on how small the mustard seed is and how sturdy the plant is that grows from it. Because the mustard tree is it's a tree, really. And in the culture and the climate that Jesus was from, a plant substantial enough for birds to regard it as a safe place to nest. And, you know, all kinds of lovely and timely applications regarding faith ensue from this starting place. I feel like I get that. This little thing that feels insignificant turns into big thing that is incredibly good. I mean, that's nice. And I am not being sarcastic. That's a lovely thought on many levels. It has also been badly misunderstood and brutally interpreted on a grand scale, forming the basis for theologies that condemn anyone that finds themselves more at home with doubt than with certainty, more inclined to skepticism than to adherence to right belief, more likely to say, I doubt it, about the big stories than to swallow just believe in one gulp because an authority figure said, that's the way it is. This week, I finally ran across an image that helped me feel like I might be able to make something life-giving of this particular enduring metaphor in the sayings of Jesus, despite all the ways that it's been abused. I'm not suggesting that this should somehow just work for you any more than using a Toto song as an illustration means I think you should become a fan of the band. I share this with you as I share whatever I do in these talky bits with the hope that it might be a positive catalyst in your own journey, a part of which might involve the reconsideration or even recovery of ideas that you've encountered before, found to be untenable at various points along the way, but that also seem to have something about them that won't quite go away. And that idea that I encountered was simply this, that when Jesus makes a big deal out of the mustard seed and says we need faith like that, he's not talking about a faith that is measured by its hefty belief content. He's talking about a faith that is defined by its remarkable growth capacity, its inherent but, you know, dormant until it starts to decay ability to become something it never looked like it could, and in the process to offer the future possibility of things like shelter for others. It's a powerful metaphor that feels to me like it's deeply consistent with Jesus' refusal to say, when he did something helpful for another person, my faith has made you well, or my faith has liberated you, or even your right belief has accomplished this. It's interesting to me that even over all the years, the translations, the interpretations, the religious gatekeeping, the surviving language in those stories is still, your faith has made you well. Your faith has liberated you. At the risk of posing a question that could be examined for a long time, so near to the end of a talky bit, how did that conflation of the ideas of faith and belief come to be? How did they end up so often being treated like synonyms in religious language and ideas? Well, it's probably a big, complicated question, but one very visible part of the answer is that the translators of the King James Bible, who, by the way, were paid by King James, and the interpretation got adjusted at a few points because James was not that fond of where they went, you know, in the early draft. One visible part of the answer is that those translators who made the English version of that deeply formative text in the history of the Christian tradition, a text which, again, kind of comes right along with the printing press and access to the, you know, the general population of these texts that until now had been presented to them by a sort of an arcane, esoteric, elite word from God by an elite class of people who could tell them what they meant, could now look at them for themselves and go, well, let me see what I think that means. This translation has that kind of heft to it in the history of this tradition. Those translators, wow, it took me a long time to get to the point, they actually conflated the meanings of the original language such that in the Matthew version of Jesus talking about faith like a mustard seed, for example, Jesus tells his bewildered followers that the reason they can't make this good thing happen that they've been trying to do is because of their, quote, unbelief. That's why the good thing isn't happening in the world that they're trying to make happen, because they don't have their beliefs right. Now, other versions of the story, including the Mulberry Bush one, don't use that language. But subsequent scholarship doesn't support that wherever it occurs in those stories. The language, the original language, as best that we can discern this, because it's traveled a long ways and through a lot of hands, is about faith, not belief. And faith, as we have been considering, can quite reasonably be understood as exploring what we don't and can't fully know or understand. And that, it seems to me, is deeply consistent with a way of exploring what we believe that can keep opening into wider and wider vistas, into ideas that, first of all, blow our minds, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, perhaps, then alter the way that we thought the world worked, and then draw us into explorations that reveal themselves to contain the space for more and more growth, instead of like, oh, there's the stopping point. It's like, no. They draw us into spaces that just go like this, that just whoosh. Rather than becoming narrower and more adamant about fixed understandings, codified laws, and so-called right belief. They don't just permission exploration. They are founded on exploration. If we regard them as being founded, as far as we can tell from the stories, if we could regard the Christian tradition as being founded in the teachings of this rabbi, Jesus, and we look at those teachings through that lens, we can see that what Jesus was doing was evolving existing ideas, not so that they could be stopped there, but as part of this long trajectory of always evolving the ideas, of always leaning into what we can't fully know and understand. But that's what faith means, right from go. This is not a new idea that Heisenberg had to create. It's a way of, it might be a lens of for the world that's been revealed to us by relatively contemporary science, for example. But I don't think it's been new to the mystics all the way along. I don't think it's been new to the people who are listening to the land or the earth all the way along. I don't think it's been a mystery to people who leaned into the realm we would use language like spirit for, perhaps, or consciousness for all along. Let me leave us with this. One of my other favorite all-time metaphors is the one that C.S. Lewis uses to describe this makeshift barn in the last book of the Chronicles of Narnia. And as in that metaphor, the mustard seed of evolving faith, turns out to be bigger on the inside than it is on the outside. The mustard seed of evolving faith turns out to be bursting with the possibility of faith beyond doubt. Not faith without doubt, but just that doubt can continue to be a catalyst that moves us deeper into the thing we might use faith for. Faith not in right belief, but in what we can never fully know and what compels us to keep exploring. I know I've said this before, but I cannot fully express how delightful it is to be part of a community committed to exploring faith and belief. Nor can I don't think I can make a convincing argument for this, but it's something I feel deeply convinced about, that communities with this sort of commitment, although they don't only exist at the table, they are relatively rare, and it's a great privilege to be a part of one. So I'm deeply grateful to be part of the table, deeply grateful that we have this to share. Thanks for being willing to share it this way and for being part of the conversation. I welcome text, phone call, email, coffee. We can be together, at least in some cases. And as Tim gestured toward, hopefully this morning, more and more. So let's continue to hope for and work for that good end.